From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Sunday, May 5th, at the First Unitarian Church of Rochester. The congregation had to decide whether to confirm Sherry Halliday Kwan as their next senior minister, and their decision that day was unanimous. Her tenure officially began just about 2 weeks ago, August 1st. And just a year ago, the First Universalist Church welcomed Reverend Lane Campbell, two women leading churches in Rochester that are often referred to as UU. But a question for you, what exactly is a Unitarian? What is Universalism? What is a Unitarian Universalist? A relative of mine once told me that she was leaving her lifelong faith as a Presbyterian to, quote, go UU. She said it was because, quote, UU accepts everyone. I'm not even sure I believe in God anymore, and they don't give me a hard time, end quote. But it's more than that. This hour, it's a conversation with two women to discuss what the mission of their work is. We're going to talk about social activism, responding to crisis. We'll discuss why go to church in 2019? In studio, it's my pleasure to welcome Reverend Sherry Halliday Kwan, Senior Minister of the First Unitarian Church of Rochester. Nice to have you here in studio. Thanks for being here.
Fantastic. Thank you for having us, Evan.
Reverend Lane Campbell is here, a settled minister at the First Universalist Church of Rochester. Welcome to you as well, Reverend. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me here.
So, Reverend Campbell, Reverend Halliday Kwan, when people hear, wait, you're at the Unitarian, you're at the Universalist, aren't those the same thing? What are we talking about here? Is it the same thing?
Well, so in my opinion, now, let's be clear, I'm new to town here, but when people default to, are those the same thing? I feel just fine about that starting place. We are both Unitarian Universalist congregations. Our work, our missions, and the ways that we work together in our faith community in partnership with the greater world as Unitarian Universalists, that is the fabric that is most important to me. Historically, we have two different religious identities, and to have two congregations in the same city, a Unitarian one and a Universalist one, is a pretty special thing. So it does retain some particular differences in terms of our aesthetics and our history. And Lane, I'll let you talk a little bit about that if you'd like.
Oh, yeah, certainly. So serving at the Universalist Church in town and having visited with the Unitarian Church in town, I would say that certainly both congregations feel different to me and hold their history. So certainly the Universalist history around a belief in universal salvation, all will be saved. And this Unitarian history, a theological history of heresy and the belief in originally the belief in one God and the denial of the divinity of the Trinity, both of these heretical Christian traditions that certainly had a lot of free thought throughout them. So your relative that said, you know, I can go to UU and not be judged for not knowing what I believe about God or not knowing whether or not I believe in God, certainly has been part of our theological history and a strain through our history on both sides throughout time. And so here in Rochester, we have a Universalist church that's downtown, a Unitarian church that's very easily accessible off of 490. We are like literally an 8-minute drive apart, and yet still have a ton of similarities and a ton of differences. It's a real gift here in Rochester.
Well, let me ask for some definitions then. What does it mean to be a Universalist?
A Universalist historically was the belief in universal salvation, was the belief that all God's children were going to be saved.
No matter what?
No matter what. And, and it kind of depends. There was some controversy within our denomination about whether or not folks would go to heaven immediately or whether or not folks would go through a remedial period of punishment before going to heaven, but that all would go to heaven. And of course, originally it was all Christians would go to heaven. But that kind of thinking always opens up the floodgates for an even broader and more inclusive vision of salvation.
So generally speaking, though, that's our definition of Universalism.
That is the historic definition.
What does it mean to be a Unitarian?
Historically, here in this country, and to Lane's point, that both of these heretical ideas have existed since the very beginning of Christianity and have popped up in different ways. But here in the U.S., historically, Unitarians have staked their community on, as Lane said, the unity of God, that there's one God, and in the possible perfection of, at the time, man, but let's say humankind, that we can work toward the good. And I think now I break from that tradition. Mm. I break from not the intellectual rigor and the space for question. That's absolutely something that we still hold in our faith. That's important to us. But the idea that we can do it by ourselves is not something that in Unitarian Universalism, most of us are affirming. I would say that most ministers, most people in our congregations say, yes, human action is incredibly important. Mm. When I say not by ourselves, whether that means a divine figure, that part might be up. It may be not necessarily up for debate, but people may have different ideas about it. Someone may say we need a little help from something else that doesn't exist on the plane of humankind. For me, that's more what's important to affirm about Unitarianism is that we as individuals cannot do it. We cannot do it alone, and that we need a community to explore ideas, to have our spirits renewed, and to work together.
Did my aunt's comments on finding new you to be more inclusive and not punishing her for having questions about her own faith, does that ring true? Is that fair?
It's not just that we don't punish it. I think we actively encourage it. Mm-hmm. If you don't have
questions, if you don't have doubt,
I think, I don't know. I don't know anyone who doesn't have questions or doubt, quite frankly. So, yes, we aim to be a spiritual home for people with questions.
Fair enough. Okay. So listeners, we've already heard from some members of the congregations. And if you want to join the conversation this hour about how you see the missions and the work that's being carried out by the women who are here in the studio and the congregations they lead, you can call the program toll free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And they are phenomenal speakers. I mean, I've had a chance to listen to some of the sermons and the subjects that they've been speaking on, and we're gonna address that. For example, Reverend Campbell just recently talked about, and I think I wrote down even the name of it that I was listening to, the spiritual practice of waking up to the immigration crisis, and we'll talk about that in a moment here. But I do want to just ask a little bit about your time in Rochester so far, and whether your own life experience made it likely or unlikely for you to end up in the positions you are in historically. I mean, how recently was it that that who you are means that you can or can't do this work? And I'll start with you, Sherry.
Certainly. So in lots of ways, I'm an unexpected person to fill the role of senior minister, or as I like to term it, lead minister of the congregation that I serve, of First Unitarian. Most of the last 200 years, this congregation has been led by men. Now, of course, there were always women doing work, and there were always women leading, but often the names that are recorded in history and the names that were held up were white men, often Harvard-educated. And the ways in which our denomination and lots of religious leadership in the U.S. has shifted towards the leadership of women and people of other genders, I think that's something that's opened up a space for me in our denomination, right? My racial identity as someone who's multiracial, who may or may not be perceived as white or Asian, even though I am, in fact, both, based on my heritage. I am, in lots of ways, an unexpected person. I am younger than someone might imagine to be someone who's leading a 750-person congregation. And I feel incredibly lucky to be here, and I also feel that there's a reason that I have been called here by this community, right? It's not simply that that I'm unexpected, but also that I am the leader for this moment in our congregation and for our congregation's work in this city and in the world. I'm losing track of your original question, Evan, because I'm thinking about the conversations that I've had with my congregation over the last few months and the ways in which we're excited to be leaning into a new chapter. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a little emotional about it and grateful to be here.
It was in the spring that some of the congregants mm-hmm. were emailing us saying, this amazing woman's coming and you've got to have a chance to talk to her. And it was really glowing and beautiful. How long ago was it that, again, someone who's as young as you, multiracial, a lesbian, could have not had this position?
So there are no other queer women or non-men of color who serve congregations of this size in my denomination, period.
Wow.
So how long has it been?
So I was going to say,
until
like,
two
even
weeks
you,
ago.
You, yeah, until two
yes.
weeks ago. Even
there
you,
has,
you.
I, yeah. Yep. Yes.
Yeah, wow. So groundbreaking. And Reverend Campbell, how do you view sort of your the work that you're doing in the space you're doing versus the historical norms?
Well, you know, I think it's important to name that that we are both ministers that our theological ancestors could have never imagined. And at the same time, there have been queer folks serving our congregations since the very beginning, whether or not they can be out of the closet and name who they were, whether or not that was safe. We come from a long heritage of folks who started serving congregations young and started serving congregations in the earlier years of their lives. However, as young queer folks, I think we've sort of like floated away from that in recent memory and in recent history. And now we have just, when I interviewed for this position and I knew that I wanted to come to First Universalist Rochester, when I was talking to the folks here, I asked the question, you know, how do you think your congregation would feel about being served by someone who is young, queer, and politically radical? And I asked that of every congregation that I interviewed with. And the response here was, from one of the members of the search committee was, well, I think it's really cool. You know, and that was just the best response, because even today, even nowadays, when I was looking for positions, when I was in search a year and a half ago, folks were still like, well, do you lead with that? Is that your primary identity? Is this going to be what we're going to be asked to become? And certainly in my ministry right now, a lot of the work that we are doing is around sort of updating our commitment to inclusion. I serve a congregation that is deeply committed to LGBTQIA inclusion. And now we're having conversations about how to be more expansive around gender. How do we question the ways that we use men and women, sisters and brothers in some of our hymnody, in some of our readings? How can we be more expansive in some of the broad welcome that we offer? You know, for me, I experienced a call to ministry very young. I experienced a call to ministry at the age of 16, which is fairly rare nowadays, though becoming more common in our denomination. And the piece for me that feels really important is when I was 16, I really needed encouragement. I needed to see folks that were leading congregations that that were, you know, sort of closer to me in age and felt like they could be role models for me. And so both Reverend Sherry and I have that opportunity here to be role models for folks who are experiencing calls to ministry young.
And so let me ask you, and I want to be careful because I'm not a theologian, and you know, I'm trying to know kind of my place and not speak with too much precision about something I'm sort of speculating on. Mm-hmm. But for example, in this community, I mean, you're relatively new to Rochester, but we've had a history of local congregations pushing back. Right now, the Methodist Church is having its own sort of struggle about what they're going to do. Asbury First is having those conversations probably right now. We have Corpus Christi and Spiritus Christi that resulted, which I'm sure you're familiar mm-hmm. with, over some of these questions about who's allowed to even, you know, be a minister, who's allowed to even lead a congregation. And for some Catholics, that feels like an outdated question, like, I can't believe we're still doing it this way. And for some Catholics, and I'm going to, again, sort of get out of my own lane, but my analysis is the current Pope of the Catholic Church, Francis, vis-a-vis Benedict, who preceded him, Benedict was more in the, hey, there are strict rules. And if we don't grow and aren't large as a church, or as large as we could be if we open more doors, it's because the rules are strict and we have expectations, and that matters. And the scripture matters, and the expectations for what it means to be a Catholic matters. Whereas Francis seems to be different than that. And I suspect you're both going to say, hey, we're here for the UU side of things. You know, you're not going to judge the Catholics. But I find it interesting that right now, different churches in different ways are grappling with this. Does it surprise you? Do you try not to comment on that? Do you look at your Catholic brothers, sisters, and whatever terms, I mean, to kind of...
Siblings.
Siblings. Siblings.
Cousins.
To build on your point. Do you look at that and think, come on, get with it here? You know, or do you think, hey, that's your business in your denomination? How do you feel about that?
Well, I think many denominations are struggling with this right now, especially around how to create a relevant faith for our time. and how do we create a faith that's going to be relevant and speak to folks that are in more of a millennial generation? This is a huge challenge, I think, for all of us who are in religious work and in a religious field. And, you know, for me right now, I can say that it is my wish and my hope and my desire that all denominations and all faith groups get on board and get on board with LGBTQIA inclusion, because it's literally a matter of life and death. I mean, in our congregations and in Unitarian Universalism, over the course of especially our recent history, we have so many people who have come through our doors who are hurting because of theologies that said you are not worthy, theologies that said you are not worthy of human dignity, who you are is bad fundamentally at your core. And we have a lot of folks in our congregations who are having to heal from a lot of that, what I would say, bad theology. I mean, to not affirm that each human being is sacred and worthy, and that all love is sacred and worthy. I mean, I think that is so key, and that is a really key justice issue of our time, and something that certainly as Unitarian Universalists, we have still even had to grow along certain lines and expand our views. It's literally a matter of life and death. We see such high rates of attempted suicide, completed suicides in LGBTQ communities, especially with young people who have heard, you know, theological messages that because your family is a part of this congregation or this denomination, who you are is bad, or who you are needs to be kept a secret, who you are needs to be denied. And the closet is a really dangerous place to live in. So,
yeah, that's absolutely right. And not just risk of suicide, but murder of trans women, right? And so the ways in which, yes, is there a private and personal frustration where I think there's an obvious theological standpoint, a place of love and growth where I'd like to see our brethren come to, our siblings? Absolutely. Do I think that, as Lane said, we have plenty of room to grow in our own denomination, in our own ways? Also, that is absolutely true. I mean, not to be terribly cavalier about it, but of course, other denominations who do not in the same way affirm the things that we do, to some extent, is a recruitment strategy. As Lane said, people come into our congregations hurting, and we can provide a spiritual home and a place of healing. And I don't want our work to be only that. It doesn't have to be. There is too much good work and too much ministry to be done in the world. And so as much as we can be a resource to other denominations and to leaders of those congregations, I open my door to that.
And one more question before I turn it over to some listeners. And we've got a lot to discuss. In fact, this hour is already flying, I think, with the reverends. I think, Reverend Campbell, you mentioned that as you thought about your time in Rochester, you're kind of asking the congregation to accept I thought you said political radical. Is that a fair term?
I would say yes, that is a fair term.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the reason I ask is because, again, this country has had this history of debating, well, you know, should we separate our faith from politics? Can we separate our faith from politics? Is there sort of a moral requirement to try to govern in a way that isn't sort of just catering to one's personal faith? Or if you are a part of a faith, what does it mean? What does it mean to be either a Christian or a believer of some? So let me ask both of you a broad kind of question, and then to talk a little bit about political radicalism. Mm-hmm. And then we'll get some phone calls. Okay. Just to kind of help listeners understand here, when we think about Jesus Christ was the person that we understand Jesus Christ was, do you believe that he was divine? And do you believe that that his message is maybe distorted often or misunderstood in many modern but not all Christian circles?
Well, so it's probably worth mentioning also that though we are historically a Christian denomination,
yes,
many of our congregations and many of our congregants don't identify as Christian.
Right.
I personally do not.
Right. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask this.
Right.
Because
certainly,
looking at the history, it's so fascinating.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you raising that.
Yes.
I mean, of course, there are Christians among us, people who come to Unitarian Universalism with a strong Christian identity.
Usually disaffected?
Not always. Sometimes they're coming from another denomination, or sometimes they're raised Unitarian Universalism, and the teachings and the life, the ministry of Jesus is an important model for them. And that being said, do I think Jesus is divine? Absolutely. I think every person who has moved upon this earth holds a bit of the divine. So, tricky
answer
to that.
But
not uniquely divine.
Okay.
Do I think had an interesting ministry that we can draw many examples from and lessons from? Absolutely. Do I think that that is often mobilized in ways that I wish that, quite frankly, people did not? Has it been mobilized in ways that do violence and harm? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Reverend Campbell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thank you so much for making that point, Reverend Sherry, because I feel like that is so key for us to embrace, is that certainly that I too believe that all people are divine, and I think that is a central piece that many folks can ascribe to in Unitarian Universalism. I believe oftentimes the messages around Jesus' life, Jesus' ministry, those stories, there are ways that those stories can be used to tell many different stories, and to tell stories that can be harmful or stories that can be healing. I think especially right now, some of the stories that I gravitate to in the life of Jesus are sort of the turning of the tables, right?
Oh, yeah.
and you know, sort of saying, you know, we need to drive out some of the money changers and some of the desire for wealth and for profit from our religious institutions, and to really sort of embrace ways that we can be more radically together. How are we breaking bread together? How are we sharing a vision of abundance, of loaves and fishes, as it were? But I think that there are multiple ways to sort of take perspectives on the stories of Jesus. And one of the ways that one person in my congregation in particular that I'm thinking of and drawing to mind in heart right now are to take a look at who else was in the stories. I mean, these are stories of community. These are stories of multiple different perspectives. And so for us, it's not always about Jesus. It's also about, you know, who were the different people that surrounded him, and what were their lenses on these different stories that we tell.
Well, recently, in the Washington Post this week, Elizabeth Brunig, the columnist, had a piece on why evangelical Christians are staying with the president and are likely to vote perhaps in even bigger numbers in 2020 for the president. It's a piece worth reading. It's an interesting one because she spent a lot of time talking to people in evangelical Christian circles. And if you have those questions, I think that that's one possible source for answers. But then there's this question of whether sort of faith is political. I mean, is faith political to you?
Absolutely.
Reverend? Yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, that is not to say that politicians and legislators and public leaders should use their private faith to determine their lives of others. And yet, for people whose values are drawn from a community, drawn from a tradition, and I think all of us are doing that to some extent, whether or not that's articulated in a religious community, everything that we bring into the world comes from somewhere. And so the ways that people legislate, the decisions that we make, are going to be grounded in that. And I think that's appropriate, right? I do think faith has something to say to politics, but that is not to say that politicians should be putting religion at the forefront of the way that they do their work. That being said, as a faith leader, do I think that my work moves into politics? Absolutely, because my work involves the way people decide things, the way people want to be in relationship with each other. By definition, my work involves the body politic.
Okay, Reverend Campbell.
I think that in our denomination, in our faith, and in many different faith contexts, we see our political work as an expression of our faith. We see our justice work as an expression of our faith. For me, it feels certainly dangerous to align with politicians as individuals, but certainly where the issues are at stake, and when we're talking about different moral justice issues, I think this is, as our denomination's president, who will be coming to visit us in October, Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, would tell us, this is no time for a casual faith. I mean, we really need to be able to be out there and taking a stand on many of these moral issues. I mean, you talked about earlier immigration. We're seeing, you know, the defunding of choice right now happening in our country and especially in our state. We're seeing ways that that the political are, you know, the political moves and where funds go and what decisions are being made are certainly affecting so many folks in our community. For me, certainly, my work is inherently political.
Okay. And to kind of follow that idea, that this is no time to be,
no time for a casual faith.
No time for a casual faith. So your congregants, whatever their background, and I have no doubt you have a diversity in just about every sense of the word, probably socioeconomically too. But let's aim this question at people who are of comfortable means, who, you know, everyone's busy. They're trying to provide for family and think about, you know, what's for dinner tonight and what's going on this weekend. And it, you know, sometimes it's hard to kind of get unburdened from your own daily and weekly scheduling to kind of think more broadly. But for people of means right now, taking that thread of this is no time for sort of a passive faith, is there a moral responsibility to get more involved in causes that you think that are where people are vulnerable right now? Is there something beyond just tending to your family day to day, week to week? Is there a moral responsibility to do more, Lane?
Yes. Yes, there certainly is. I think there is more to life than just than surviving and getting by. And I don't want to draw a false dichotomy between parenting and what is inherently political work. I think certainly there are justice aspects to raising kids. I spent 5 years as a religious education minister. And so I know that, you know, the stories that we read to our children, the protests that we take our children to, the, you know, the voices that we expose our children to, that is actually inherently political work. And I think some of the function right now of church and of church communities is to help us get in touch with what is larger than just the day-to-day pieces that are within the scope of what we need to do to get by. Like, we go to church to learn how to live, and to learn how to live lives of meaning and purpose, and to embrace that there is something larger than just what is available to us in this in our limited scope. And I will own, you know, for me, I am a privileged white person that does come from means. And because of that, I have a responsibility and an accountability to folks that don't share that identity with me, folks that do not come from the same means that I come from, that do not come from the same racial background or class background that I come from, to be doing this work and to be doing this work in partnership, doing justice work in partnership with communities that hold more marginalized identities than mine.
So to be blunt, and maybe you won't like the question, but would you say to people of sort of a similar background to yourself, white, as you say, sort of privileged people of means, if they say, look, I'm doing my best just to kind of, you know, get through the week and make lunch for my kids, and would you say to them, I know, but you're not doing enough?
What I would say to them is, I know, I hear you, and the time is now to wake up. Like, you are needed. What I would say is not necessarily what you aren't doing is enough, but maybe how can you incorporate some of the justice work into what you're doing in the day-to-day world? I mean, I don't think a message of what you're doing is not enough actually is helpful, but I think the message more is, you know, what are you doing right now to wake up and to shake yourself out of complacency? Because we are in this movement moment right now. We are in a particular time period in this country's history where a lot is being revealed that has been held under the surface for a long time through our own complacency and quietness and through sort of sitting back and allowing things to happen. And our voices, our presence, they're needed right now.
Okay, Reverend?
Absolutely. Reverend Lane, I appreciate the distinction that you are making in terms of not wanting to say that parenting is not political, right? The ways in which I talk about my faith being political, it does mean public action, it means rallies, it means legislative interaction, but it means that, you know, when we talk about specifically talking to people of means, people who are in positions of power, it is an inherently political action when you look at your own hiring practices to either have or not have an anti-racism framework around the ways you make hiring decisions. It is an inherently political action to think about power relationships and equity in rearing your children. So the ways in which this work spreads out into every dimension of our lives feels really clear to me. When we ask folks to wake up, when we ask folks to do something differently, in some ways it can feel like more, right? We are asking something. So for your aunt's point of people don't bother me or challenge me, and I don't know that those were your exact words.
I think roughly it was, you know, I have doubts and I'm not looked down upon for having doubts.
Great, yeah. So not looked down upon for having doubts, certainly. But it is, our faith communities are not a place where we allow people to stay too comfortable, right? So comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable is something we take seriously, I think. And so when we ask people to do something differently, to wake up to this time that we're in and use your power in a way that can, that is organized for impact, I don't think we're asking people to add on something extra, to do all the things that you're already doing and do something additional, because people are tired. People are doing a lot, right? And so when Lane talks about tapping into meaning, that involves tapping out of noise, out of urgency, mm-hmm. out of the ways in which we live our lives that, quite frankly, move us, I think, to that numbness. That numbness doesn't come from we're being well spent. Our energy is not going where our lives have set us up to live out of. Our energy is being frittered away. And I think what we do at church is call people back into a place where, having discerned your deepest values, which is an ongoing process, but having a chance to do that then allows us to move out of that place.
And so for people of privilege, and wow, I know listeners, phone calls and emails, we've got so much already. So we're going to try to rip through as much as we can in the next 20 minutes. The last question then that I'll have for the reverends is an action item. What is an example of the kind of action you think does represent the you are needed and this is you stepping up, Reverend?
Well, you know, certainly this upcoming week we have an opportunity for folks to be taking action this upcoming Sunday. And our both Reverend Sherry and I have been deeply moved by the response to the recent rash of mass shootings that we have seen, the recent rash of gun violence that we are seeing in our country. And so this upcoming Sunday, we have opportunities for folks to come out to Washington Square Park at 2 p.m. for a rally that is led by Moms Demand Action for common sense gun laws, and then also to come to church, to come to First Universalist Church, to take part in a worship service that is going to speak to both our hearts and our spirits in this time, and also call us into action at 3 p.m. at First Universalist Church, just following the rally. So we're going to go straight from the streets into the church building, and we'll actually have opportunities there for folks to take some direct action right now and start to reach out to and call their legislators, and also commit to partnerships with folks like Rise Up Rochester, which is an organization in our community that is doing work around gun violence and the ways that it affects the city of Rochester. So that's, you know, that's, of course, this is the action item that I'm like mainly focused on right now this week. And I'm sure, you know, one action item, it's a tough ask actually. But that's the one I would lift up at least for today.
Okay.
I'm going to take a different tact because I would have said what Reverend Lane said, but I would ask everyone every week with someone that they love, someone they trust and respect deeply, to name something that they value in their lives and then name something that they did that week that connected to that value. And also name something that failed to affirm that value, something that flew in the opposite direction. It's a spiritual practice, and I'm asking folks to do that because I believe that that type of work allows us to better take action, to do things like show up on Sunday afternoon and get to phone banking our legislators.
All right. We're talking to Reverend Sherry Halliday Kwan and Reverend Lane Campbell. Sherry is senior minister, lead minister.
Either works.
Of the First Unitarian Church of Rochester since August 1st. And Reverend Campbell is a settled minister at the First Universalist Church of Rochester since a year ago. And they're sharing their views on the work they're doing, the mission of their work, the intersection of faith and politics, and a lot more. And your feedback is next. Coming up in our second hour, we preview the Rochester Fringe Festival. The 2019 edition kicks off on September 10th. It's a chance for you to maybe plan your calendar. We'll talk about what's in the Spiegel tent this year, some of the big names who are coming, and also some of the local artists whose work will be featured among the dozens of performances, hundreds really. The pedestrian drive-in, what's that? What are they doing for Kids Day? We talk all things Fringe next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Colin on the phone first. Go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, I'm glad to see the conversation is already leaning this way. And I really want to say, you know, for the First Unitarian and the community around it, one of the greatest losses in the last couple of years was the loss of the moving out of town of Emily and Marcus, the associate ministers there, who really were deeply, deeply involved and committed and engaged in the broader social justice movement outside of the church. And I guess I'm hoping to hear, maybe because we've talked about it in a broader sense, in more specifics, what the upcoming plans of the First Unitarian are to do the same.
Okay, to engage the social justice community, then. Is that right?
Yeah, to more broadly engage in this the continued activism and organizing that's already happening in town.
All right, Colin, thanks for the phone call. Sherry, you want to start?
Absolutely, great. So, Colin, you're talking specifically about my congregation and two of the assistant ministers who were serving there. And one of the great things about our congregation is that we do have a team of ministers. It's a fairly large congregation, and that it allows each minister to focus on certain areas. And right now we're in a place where I'm just beginning, and we're sort of going to figure out how that works. There's this long tradition at First Unitarian of social justice work, and a lot of that work has been led from internal to the congregation. We have deeply committed congregants to various types of social justice work. So part of my job, I think, in my first year here is getting to know the broader Rochester community before I dive into social justice work led by my congregation, internal to my congregation. So I've said to some of my leaders that during this first year, as I get my bearings, most of my social justice work is going to look like learning about the community and community partners here in Rochester. So there's going to be some strategy involved. There's going to be some learning involved. And hopefully on my part, there's going to be a lot of humility involved, because I know I've been here for 3 weeks, quite frankly. Right. So.
Okay. Do you want to hit that too, Reverend Campbell?
Sure. Well, I think so one of the pieces that I love about having Reverend Sherry in town is that this is getting to hear from a newer and a fresh perspective over at First Unitarian, and having someone to collaborate with. I mean, when we're talking about this worship service at the end of this week, this is something that we are collaborating on and collaborating with local partners on. And for me, my first year looked very similar. And so this upcoming year, the congregation that I serve is deepening relationships with community partners. We're actually partnering with Spiritus Christi around a civil rights heritage park that they are building here in Rochester, and doing some work with that congregation and with a coalition of congregations, predominantly Black-led congregations that are supporting this civil rights heritage park. Also, for me and for the congregants that I serve, we are getting deeply involved with Rock Acts and doing some work around the Police Accountability Board, inviting more people of faith to show up to advocate for the Police Accountability Board, which will be on the ballot in November. And, you know, so I think the opportunities for partnership here in Rochester abound with community organizations. And as faith leaders, we have so much certainly to offer, to bring the spirit to the different community organizations that we partner with. And also, we have so much to learn from our different community partners in justice work.
Let me get on the phone. This is Karen in Brockport next. Go ahead, Karen.
Good afternoon. This is the time of year when families are thinking about going back to school, a time of new beginnings. So So I was wondering, what might your congregations offer to children that is different from school?
Okay.
I love this question.
Right. Yeah, this is great.
Okay.
You start, Lynn, or shall I?
Was this a plant question then?
No, it certainly not. was not.
Thank you, Karen. Go ahead.
So, one of the pieces that our congregation offers at First Universalist Church downtown is an opportunity for families to worship together. We offer multi-generational worship services one time a month, times that are worship services that are more embodied, interactive, story-based, and fun for folks, I think, of all ages, as well as being spiritually nourishing and having a message of depth and weight. And that is extremely different from school. I mean, the ways that we offer acceptance to young ones who want to wiggle around a little bit, ways that we offer spiritual sustenance for folks, no matter how young or how old, just an opportunity to be together and to sing together. I feel like opportunities for singing together nowadays in our culture and society are really rare. And so that's just one of the things that we would offer that would be different from school. I could go on for a while about this question. It's a really good one, but I'll certainly turn it over to Rev. Sherry.
Right. Reverend Lane knows I'll have to tackle her if she goes on too long, because if I don't get a chance to talk about this question, I'd be in serious trouble. My congregation takes what we offer our children and youth incredibly seriously. That is central to our mission, central to who we are. And we have a slightly different approach, though we do have 6 or 7 times a year, we worship together, where adults and youth and young babies are all together. And those are incredible services. And I'm really excited to worship with this congregation at these particular moments. And one of those is right when we go back to school, so September 8th. Most Sundays, you'll find that the adults and our children are in separate places. Both have worship, both have this place to both be comforted and healed, as well as challenged and awakened. And for our youth, for our young people, it's an incredibly magical place. It is a place where they are invited to co-lead our worship. They're invited to, by age group, learn in a variety of different modes about things that are important, that are at the very heart and center of who we are as Unitarian Universalists. And religious education is a huge part of why people come to First Unitarian.
Well, thank you for the phone call, Karen. I appreciate that. Bruce writes to say, in response to Reverend Sherry's comment about Jesus having part of the divine, because you think everyone has part of the divine, even if Jesus wasn't uniquely divine. Bruce says, no way could I consider someone like Trump part of the divine. Wants to know if you do. Says, some people do not lead a life like that at all. Trump is such a racist, and the meetings that he holds advance racism, homophobia, and xenophobia, and he sees no divine there. Do you see any divine in the president?
I am no fan of the president, and do I think that there's an inherent sacredness, a dignity to his life that no matter what he does or no matter what I think of him cannot be erased? Do I think there's possibility for redemption and change? Absolutely. Do I think he should be our president? Let's be frank, I probably won't vote for him in the next election. I certainly didn't vote for him in the last election. It's not really the point. Do I think there is a spark of the divine? Absolutely. To just briefly go back to what I actually think about Jesus, I do think there's a spark of the divine about Jesus. What I think about Jesus, the main point for me, is that he was a political radical who so loved his people that he died a convicted criminal at the hands of the state. So, you know, does that inform how I view the president of this country? Yeah, I think so.
Is there divine in this president, Reverend?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we as Unitarian Universalists believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all people. And one of the pieces of our theology and one of the challenges is to draw that circle wide. And certainly coming from a universalist standpoint, as a minister at a historically universalist church, we draw that circle wide enough to include the president. We draw that circle wide enough to include folks who are living their white supremacist beliefs out loud. Do I say that those folks have absolutely no divinity to them? No. Is it a spiritual practice to regularly consider how to draw that circle wider? Yes, it's. I certainly have had many Sundays where the comments in the receiving line are, I'm really struggling this week with how to see the divine in our president, or how to see the divine in, you know, the white supremacist attacks that we saw in Charlottesville, or what we saw, you know, a couple of weeks ago, even in El Paso. And so, you know, like, see, it's certainly a challenge of our faith to see the divine in those that are hard for us to love. And yet that is the challenge. That is the theological challenge for us.
Let me read Gray's comment. Gray says, I've belonged and attended and given and volunteered at each of the U's. They are generally good, well-intentioned, tolerant people. That is, in my experience, until you question the politically correct or accepted beliefs. For instance, questioning the Catholic Church as a misogynistic institution that inhibits people is almost a support. Everyone agrees about that. Make the same claim about Islam and its treatment of women and gay people, and you're Islamophobic. Simply questioning whether gender fluidity can be a psychosis or is a social construct gets you on the unwoke deplorable list. So I think you might be no different than many, tolerant of those who agree only with them. Hard words from Gray. Reverend, I'll start with you, Sherry.
Certainly. Well, Gray, thank you for your contributions, for your volunteering work, and for your participation in our communities. I can imagine that for those for whom, let's say, violent attacks against gender fluid people or Islam are not subjected to those things, it can seem like political correctness, to use Gray's words, is something that limits their ability to express themselves. I can understand that. And I also think that when we talk about political correctness, when we talk about the ways in which words can be harmful or the ways in which we hold other people in respectful terms, what we're actually doing is asking people to use terms that allow other people to move comfortably. It can be a challenge. There's no doubt about that. But we're asking to share the discomfort that the ways in which in our communities and in the world at large, there are ways of being. So, for example, talking about Islam in derisive terms, that's something we can find in the world almost anywhere we go here, right? In the U.S., that is. And there are very few places that are, and maybe that's putting it too strongly, I'd like to think there are more places, but I do think it's incumbent upon us as a place of sanctuary, as a place that is looking to move the world towards a place of greater inclusion, that the ways in which we prioritize, in which we give preferential treatment, to use a liberation theology term, to people who are disempowered by systemic injustice is a huge part of the ways that I see that uncomfortable way in which we are in partnership or relationship in our communities is one of the principles that I'm using, right? So I know it can be challenging, and I'm inviting us to face that challenge together. Do I think that we are intolerant of the unwoke? I do think the paradox of tolerance, right, does ask us to take a strong commitment to breaking free of ways in which certain groups of people are placed in harm's way in wider society. Absolutely.
Okay, Reverend Campbell.
You know, it feels difficult in some ways to talk about some of these concepts because they are so complex. And can I say that Unitarian Universalism perfectly lives our values all the time? No, I cannot say that. And I can't actually say that probably about any faith group. You know, when we're talking about different pieces around gender, around misogyny, around Islamophobia, these are really complex issues and ones where I think, you know, being in religious community and being able to be in conversation with one another is a huge gift, actually, to be able to take apart some of these complexities and to take a look at systems that oppress people with a complex lens, instead of just kind of making a more broad sweeping a generalization around one religious perspective or another, around one group of people or another. Though, you know, saying that, I 100% affirm that that folks who are living a non-binary identity or a gender expansive identity are not living with a psychosis. My life partner and my spouse is someone who lives with that identity, and certainly we are here to value the inherent worth and dignity of all peoples. And, you know, I appreciate Gray lifting up the point, and I appreciate Gray's contribution to our communities, and appreciate the ways that folks have walked through both communities. It's really interesting to hear from someone who has been part of both communities, because I think there are many people here in Rochester who share that experience, being part of both First Universalist and First Unitarian. And I think it's just kind of one of the gifts of being here in Rochester and having shared UU communities.
Will you both come back sometime?
Absolutely. Yeah. At your invitation.
Well, boy, you're going to regret saying that. And why don't you let our listeners know again what's coming up on Sunday as we get ready to close the program? What do you want them to know about what's happening?
Certainly. So this upcoming Sunday, we will be holding a service of mourning and waking up to the current realities of gun violence in our country. And we will be holding that at First Universalist Church at 3 p.m., 150 South Clinton.
150 South Clinton, 3 p.m. on Sunday. If you want to be there for that. The ubiquitous Jeremy Chung emailed to say how happy he was to have met you and worked with you. And he is part of Moms Demand, which has done some work in our community. I know they've been partners as well. So
wonderful.
A lot of work regarding gun violence and honoring those lost, but questions about the path forward. That's just one of the things. And otherwise, you're just going to have to go to the congregations and meet these reverends if you want to learn more. Reverend Lane Campbell, settled minister at First Universalist Church of Rochester. Lovely having you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Reverend Sherry Halliday Kwan, senior minister, lead minister of the First Unitarian Church of Rochester. Reverend, thank you so much.
Thank you as well.
Short break, more connections coming up.